I think that anyone who cares for the work of Emily Dickinson at all cares for the experience of surprise, the surprises that she gives us in her adjectives, adverbs, sometimes her verbs, the whole character of her epithets, which is so incomparably fresh and strange. In the 20th century, maybe only Wallace Stevens is comparable to her in this, in that strangeness and freshness. And among the poets who preceded her, one may, I think, perhaps find some parallels in Edward Taylor. It's commonly recognized that this gift for images that go beyond the shock of recognition is enhanced by the simplicity of her prosody. But what I especially like is the way not only her diction, but her punctuation twists and syncopates those simple or even simplistic norms. So I too, like Sharon Olds, like things that she does with rhythm, although I think that perhaps what I hear in her rhythms is something a little different from what Sharon focused on. I feel that without the peculiarity of her famous dashes, the poems would have to depend solely on content, image, diction, those things which they have so strongly, but they would have to depend on them, I think, too much, because their rhythms would not be of very much interest. Once those dashes, which were, as I'm sure everyone here knows, were omitted by her conventional earlier editors, were restored, we get not a jog trot, which I think we do get without them, not a jog trot, but a dance. It's a strange dance. The strange sidling, sidestepping kind of dance. Its movement matches, I think, the unique character of her imagination. I'm going to read two very short poems of hers in which these dashes have that effect. Presentiment is that long shadow on the lawn, indicative that suns go down. The notice, the startled grass, that dark is about to pass. Now, remove dashes, and let's see what it sounds like. Presentiment is that long shadow on the lawn, indicative that suns go down. The notice, the grass, that darkness is about to pass. You can hear what I mean, can't you? And the other poem. There is a pain so utter, it swallows substance up, then covers the abyss with trance, so memory can step around, across, upon it, as one within a swoon goes safe where an open eye would drop him bone by bone. I'm not going to inflict a dashless reading upon that poem. I'm going to read first from some typescripts and then from some poems from a couple of my books. And a lot of the poems that I've been writing since my last book are rather long. I've been writing a sequence of poems, each one of which is fairly long, about Lady Julian of Norwich, the English medieval mystic, and some other poems which tend to run to length. Because Emily's poems didn't run to great length, I thought I would try to choose short poems to read today. And I have been writing short poems too, so I've selected from the short ones. I'm not going to read them in any particular order. In other words, these that I'll be reading first are all since my last book, but they're not being read in chronological order, but more or less haphazard. An estrangement. I have seen days now so unbreathing, even the aspen I thought never without one rhythmic leaf at least to signal, yes, not asleep, though my eyes are shut, even the aspen withheld itself. Someone I thought I knew turned when I followed, showed a strange face, walked on, away. I've seen days now that discarded the light that clothed them to stand blue skin in their bones. A group of poems that I've been writing, I call spin-offs. I have two sets of them, and one set came from contemplating some photographs by the photographer Peter Brown, who had asked me to write an introduction for a book of his photographs. And I did, in fact, eventually write an introduction, but while looking at the photographs, I found myself writing poems, which spun off from the pictures in an oblique way. They were not descriptions. That's why I think of them as spin-offs, like sparks flying off from some surface or from something which is struck. About a year later, I found myself writing another set of spin-offs, this time from phrases and sentences that jumped up at me from the page of what I happened to be reading, from prose works that I happened to be reading, apart from detaching themselves from their context, almost seeming to be in larger print, the way in which when I was a child of about 8 or 9, for a year approximately, I was an unexploited sort of rocking horse winner, because I used to listen to the radio accounts of big horse races, like the Derby and Grand National. This was England, of course. And I began to know who was going to win. And then I got interested and started looking at the newspaper. And again, a word would come up to me, a name, a horse would come up to me, and I would know that that was the horse that was going to win. But nobody knew, and nobody, even if my family had known, they knew nothing about horse racing, and they would not have known how to place a bet. Well, in the same way, these phrases came up for me and sparked spin-off poems. They don't have a sequential relationship to each other, but they form a set. I'm going to read you some of those. The sentences form the titles, in some cases rather long for titles. The sea's repeated gesture, stroking its blue shore throughout the night, patient, patient, determined rhetoric that never persuade the rocks unwilling to be pebbles, night and days and centuries passing before the pebbles dwindle to join the sand itself at last barring the sea's way into the land, an island forming from the silt. Yet still, all this night and all the nights of our life, the sea stroking its blue shore, patient, patient. The last heavy fairy tale in which one lays one's heart bare before the knife. The room is small, the table plain, white pine well scrubbed. The house is deep in forest. Each comes alone but watched, carefully holding in two hands that heart which till now was drumming and drumming away in its own interior anteroom, comes to center it bare and still beating on the plain table in the small room where the knife will appear, new sharpened, held invisibly. The Holy One, blessed be He, wanders again, said Jacob. He is wandering and looks for a place where he can rest. Between the pages, a wren's feather to mark what patch? Blood not dry, beaded scarlet on dusty stone. A look of wonder barely perceived on a turning face. What, who had they seen? Traces. Here's the cold inn. The wanderer passed it by, searching once more for a stable's warmth, a birthplace. She wept, and the women consoled her. The flow of tears ebbed, her blouse began to dry, but the sobs that took her by the shoulders and shook her came back for unknown reasons, and shook her again like soldiers coming back when everyone had gone. History's traffic had speeded up and smashed into gridlock all around her. The women consoled her, but she couldn't get out. Bent forward as she was, she found herself looking at her legs. They were old, the skin shiny over swollen ankles and blotched. They meant nothing to her, but they were all she could see. Her fallen tears had left their traces like snail tracks on them. The day longs for the evening. The zenith longs for the banal horizon. The north wind longs for the south, and the trudging clouds are searching, searching for that land of glowing fruit, of polished marble. But the wind that drives them is bitter. They bring winter with them. What is that promised evening? The day knows, in spite of everything, that evening will not fail. The ancient even, the luminous even. There are two more of these, of this set of spin-offs, and this is the only one of those where the source of the title sentence or phrase is of special interest. It's from a dream that Thomas Merton had, about which he wrote in a letter to Boris Pasternak. And the phrase is, I learned that her name was Proverb, the name of a figure of a young girl whom he met in his dream. I learned that her name was Proverb. And the secret names of all we meet who lead us deeper into our labyrinth of valleys and mountains, twisting valleys and steeper mountains, their hidden names are always, like proverb, promises, rune, omen, fable, parable, those we meet for only one crucial moment, gaze to gaze, or for years know and don't recognize, but of whom later a word sings back to us, as if from high among leaves, still near but beyond sight, drawing us from tree, towards the time and the unknown place where we shall know what it is to arrive. And the title of the last one is actually two sentences. The myriad past, it enters us and disappears, except that within it, somewhere, like diamond, exist the fragments that refuse to be consumed. Until sometimes an ancient mind or body, it's not clear anymore which it may be, those indurate insistences having crowded out all else, becomes all diamond, hard, transparent, cut to a thousand facets, gleaming with lights of the unseen, a primal iridescence, rainbow of death. This one is called The Absentee. Uninterpreted, the days are falling. The spring wind is shaking the trees. A nest of eggs, a nest of deaths, falling, abandoned. The palms rattle, the eucalypts shed bark and blossoms. Uninterpreted. I was thinking of that phrase, and at this moment, I cannot remember whose phrase it was. William James, was it? About the unexamined life. It's a poem about a mockingbird. The mockingbird of mockingbirds. Each year, I teach for 3 months in California at Stanford, and there are a lot of birds, singing birds, that I hear there. I'm there January through March. And this is a memorial poem for a particular mockingbird that I heard for 2 years and then no more. The mockingbird of mockingbirds. A greyish bird, the size perhaps of two plump sparrows, fallen in some field, soon flattened, a dry mess of feathers. And no one knows, this was a prince among his kind, virtuoso of virtuosos, lord of a thousand songs, debonair, elaborate in invention, fantasist, rival of nightingales. The rest of the year, I live in the Boston area, where I have a very small and shady backyard and a sort of back porch on which I attempt every year to grow morning glories in boxes, training them up a wire mesh thing around the back porch. And I don't get a great display of morning glories because I don't really get enough sunshine there because there are a lot of trees round about and other buildings. But I do get some. And in some ways, just having one, or sometimes a few more, but often just one morning glory per day is very special, actually. I can't say that I wouldn't like to have a whole fence full of them, but there is something very special about coming downstairs each morning to see a brand new morning glory, which will be faded by noon. So one has to really look at while it's there. But this particular one is perhaps a slightly sad poem. It's called Captive Flower. This morning's morning glory, trying to thrust through the wire mesh towards the sun, is trapped half open. I ease it back to see better its unfurling, but only slowly it resigns the dream. Its petals are scarred. I had not thought myself a jailer. Another poem from my backyard is called In Praise of Allium. This one's a tiny bit longer than those that I'm picking for the most part, but it didn't seem too inappropriate to the occasion. In Praise of Allium. Why? Because it's the kind of thing that I think Emily Dickinson was very good at noticing. No one celebrates the allium, the way each purposeful stem ends in a globe, a domed umbel, makes people think drumsticks, and that's that. Besides, it's related to the onion. Is that any reason for disregard? The flowers, look, are bouquets of miniature florets, each with six elfin pointed petals, and some narrower ones my eyes aren't sharp enough to count, and three stamens about the size of a long eyelash. Every root sends up a sheaf of sturdy, ridged stems. Bounty, fill your embrace. The bees care for the allium if you don't. Hear them now, doing their research, humming the arias of a honey opera. Allium, it's called. Gold fur voluptuously brushing that dreamy mauve. To one steep in bitterness, nail the rose to your mind door like a rat, a thwarted chicken hawk. Yes, it has had its day. And the water poured for you, which you disdain to drink. Yes, throw it away. Yet the fierce rose stole nothing from your cooped heart, nor plucked your timid eye. And from inviolate rock, the liquid light was drawn, that's dusty now, and your lips dry. Let me read two more of these typescripts and then turn to a couple of poems from books. This one is called Every Day. Three men spoke to me today. One, bereaved, told me his grief, saying, had God abandoned him, or was there no God to abandon? One, condemned, told me his epitaph, groomed to die. On death row, he remembers the underside of his grade school desk, air raid drill. He never expected to live even this long. He sticks his head back down between his knees, not even sad. One, a young father, told me how he had needed his child even before it was conceived, how he had planted a garden too big to hoe. He told me about the small leaves near his window, how he had seen in them their desire to be the world. With this one, I sat laughing, eating, drinking wine. The same word, he said. She has the same word for me and the dog. She loves us. Every day, I hear enough to fill a year of nights with wondering. Beatrice Hawley was a wonderful person and wonderful poet who died last year, and I'm editing her posthumous manuscripts, and I think that she is someone who really was influenced by and has some strong affinities with Emily Dickinson. I wrote a poem after her death called Missing Beatrice for Beatrice Hawley, 1944 to 1985. Goodness was a fever in you. Anyone might glow in the heat of it, go home comforted. For them, a shawl. For you, fire at the bone. You knew more than was good for you. Your innocence was peat bog water, subtle and dark. That cold it was, that pure. Kindness. Didn't we act as though we could cut an endless supply from you, like turf from a bog? Smoke of that empty hearth, fragrant still. Your words cupped in our hands to drink. But you, you're gone, and we never really saw you. And the last of the typescripts is a variation on a theme by Rilke, a theme which is in the first stanza of the first poem of the first part of Rilke's Book of Hours. So it's not a translation, but it's a variation on something that is in that first stanza. A certain day became a presence to me. There it was, confronting a sky, air, light, a being. And before it started to descend from the height of noon, it leaned over and struck my shoulder as if with the flat of a sword, granting me honor and a task. The day's blow rang out metallic, or it was I, a bell awakened. And what I heard was my whole self saying, singing what it knew, I can. This is another Morning Glory poem, and it's called Concurrence. This was in Candles in Babylon. And it's in the section of that book called Age of Terror. Each day's terror, almost a form of boredom. Madmen at the wheel and stepping on the gas and the brakes no good. And each day one, sometimes two, morning glories, full blue, blue sometimes flecked with magenta, each lit from within with the first sunlight. I've been struck all my life, actually, by the extraordinary simultaneity of opposites and of the things that are happening at any time, if one just stops to think about them somewhere where one is not. I wrote a poem about this many years ago called To the Reader, which I can't quote because I have a terrible memory. I would know if someone quoted it to me if they got it wrong, but I can't do it right myself without having a book in front of me. But it's about that same thing, like the one I just read. From Life in the Forest, this poem struck me as not entirely unsuitable. Talking to grief. Ah, grief. I should not treat you like a homeless dog who comes to the back door for a crust, for a meatless bone. I should trust you.
I should coax you into the house and give you your own corner, a worn mat to lie on, your own water pit. You think I don't know you've been living under my porch? You long for your real place to be ready before winter comes. You need your name, your collar and tag. You need the right to warn off intruders, to consider my house your own, and me your person, and yourself my own dog. And I'm going to finish up with four poems from Oblique Prayers, which was my last book. First, a poem called Decipherings, which is actually in four very short parts. I dedicated it to Givic, a French poet whom I had translated some years ago, because I felt some affinity of form and style in it with his poetry, although unfortunately he can't read English, so. Decipherings, one. When I lose my center of gravity, I can't fly. Levitation, a stone cast straight as a lark to fall plumb and rebound. Two, half a wheel, a rising sun without spokes, an arch. Half a loaf reveals the inner wheat, leavened transubstantiation. Three, a child grows in one's body, pushes out and breaks off. Nerves denying their non-existence twist and pinch long after that otherness float far, thistle down engine, up and over horizon's rampart. Four, felt life grows in one's mind. Each semblance forms and reforms, cloudy linked with the neck, and the neck chimes and gamelan gong resound, pondering, picking the tesserae, blue or perhaps vermilion. What one ached for is the mosaic music makes in one's ears transform. Thinking about El Salvador, I might say this could equally be called thinking about Nicaragua as attacked by the Contras. There are indeed a number of places in the world that it could apply to. It was written originally in 1982, and I then added a note when I published it in 1984 to say that the title originally included that date, 1982. But alas, the death squads and the army continued the slaughter with United States help. Thinking about El Salvador. Because every day they chop heads off, I'm silent. In each person's head they chopped off was a tongue. For each tongue they silence, a word in my mouth unsays itself. From each person's head, two eyes looked at the world. For each gaze, they cut a line of seeing, unwords itself. Because every day they chop heads off, no force flows into language. Thought think themselves worthless. No blade of machete threatens my neck, but its muscles cringe, tighten. My voice hides in its throat cave, ashamed to sound into that silence, the silence of rape women, of priests and peasants, teachers and children, of all whose heads every day float down the river and rot and sink, not Orpheus' heads still singing, bound for the sea, but mute. Okay. going to make it three. It's cheating, but they are short. This one is called Mappemonde, that old word for the map of the world. Nonchalant clouds below me dangle shadows into the curved river at Saskatoon. Atlas of frontiers long redrawn, gazetteer of obsolete cities, a jet vapor garland stretches and stretches to link your incantation and breaks. Still audible, stiffly revolving, the globe of the world creaks out enticement. Decades pile up like thunderheads. Oh, geography, on your thick syrups I float and float. I glide through your brew of bitter herbs. Mumble a mountain, low and round, hums in green and hums in tune down in the dream time. World, you grow vaster. Our time cannot encompass you. Seeing for a moment. I thought I was growing wings. It was a cocoon. I thought now is the time to step into the fire. It was deep water. Eschatology is a word I learned as a child, the study of last things. Facing my mirror, no longer young, the news always of death. The dogs rising from sleep and clamoring and howling, howling. Nevertheless, I see for a moment, that's not it. It is the first thing, word after word, float through the glass toward me. And the last poem I'll read is very short, and it's called Candlemas. Candlemas is the feast that celebrates the infant Jesus being taken to be presented at the temple, and the old Simeon recognizing him as the Messiah. Candlemas. With certitude, Simeon opened ancient arms to infant light. Decades before the cross, the tomb, and the new life, he knew new life. What depth of faith he drew on, turning illumined toward deep night. Thank you.